Good evening, everybody. We are drawing awfully close to the end of the book of Acts. I think it's this week and next week, right? And then we're done. Been a long journey, and yet we kind of flew through Acts. The way we divided it up, we took it in these big chunks, and so it's been really kind of fun to do this flyover approach and sort of get the whole scope of the book. We didn't spend a lot of time digging down into some of the stuff that's here that's juicy and detailed and wonderful, but it's profitable for us to be able to see from beginning to end all the stuff that God was doing over the course of this time period in his church. So we're in Acts chapter 27 tonight, and this morning we were studying Epaphroditus from the book of Philippians, and I was sort of laughing internally a little bit as Eric was teaching us about how he was a gambler, which doesn't sound like a good thing at all, right? Well, tonight we're going to take a look at Paul, and in this situation, though it's from a human perspective, it may sound like Paul was gambling an awful lot in this story. He was far from it. He knew exactly what he was doing, exactly what the outcome was going to be. There was absolutely no risk whatsoever for Paul in the events of chapter 27 in Acts, which is pretty amazing. Paul is the only person that is not probably scared out of his wits in this story. So, again, we'll set up where we are and a little bit about what this chapter is before we get into the text. It is the whole chapter, so we're going to read it as we go rather than reading it and then going back. Too much to do that. So Paul has been tried or had hearings before three different important officials after his arrest in Jerusalem. First, he was tried before Felix, and a funny story about that, something that I neglected to share with all of you. But Felix was the one who heard him and then kept him in prison for a couple years, hoping that people would bribe him to let him go, not really wanting to irritate the Jews, but not really having a good case against him, so he sort of sat on Paul for a long time. And in a prior copy of the scriptures that I had, quite a while ago, one of the subtitles, you know, the little editor's notes on the chapter was Felix procrastinates. Well, I was sitting there looking at it one day and I'm like, huh, Felix procrastinates, that's a pretty funny name. Oh, Felix procrastinates. Wow. So Felix has done nothing about Paul other than keep him in a jail for 2 years. And when Felix is recalled by Caesar as governor, he's replaced by Festus. Festus is the new guy on the block. Things are bad in Judea when he arrives. He doesn't want to provoke anybody. He doesn't want to rock the boat. He's got to do what he's got to do, but he's got to appease the Jews because things are kind of a hotbed of insurrection. And his job as a Roman governor is to keep things from blowing up. So Festus has Paul and doesn't know what to do with him. So he says, well, okay, he gives him a little hearing. He can't find anything to stick on Paul. So he goes and has another little hearing in front of Agrippa, Herod Agrippa, who's the Judean king. And Agrippa also can't say that Paul has violated any laws, certainly not any laws that would be a death penalty kind of a law. But Paul has already appealed to Caesar. And according to Roman law, he's got to go have a hearing in front of Caesar. So at this point now, Paul is being sent off to Rome to go have a hearing before Caesar on unspecified charges. A strange circumstance. I'm sure Festus was sweating this one, because this looks bad for him to do this. Chapter 26, a lot of it was Paul's defense in front of Festus. It's wonderful because Paul doesn't lay out a factual legal defense, at least not at length. He does address Festus legally in a couple of ways, but primarily he gives him gospel truth, right? And Agrippa says, well, are you trying to convert me? Paul says, yeah, of course I am. I would love to see you come to know Jesus Christ for who he is, the Lord of all creation, the Messiah. So chapter 26, we flew through this beautiful, really kind of sermon that Paul preached to Agrippa, defending the Christian faith. This week is about 180 degrees opposite in what it is. Chapter 26, big doctrine-heavy sermon. Chapter 27, we get like 3 or 4 statements from Paul, and 0 of them are even doctrinal. So tonight there will be no application for this sermon. This is if there's no commandment, there's no doctrine given, there is no application for us. However, we can draw some really good implications, things that we can learn from Paul and from the situation that Paul finds himself in. So I won't be giving you application points. I'll be giving you some implication points this evening. This chapter is chapter 27 is kind of the exciting final chase scene in a movie. So if the book of Acts were to be turned into a movie, there'd be ups and downs, right? Like every movie, you got big exciting parts, you've got, you know, slow spots, the development in the movie, you got, you know, conflicts that arise, conflicts that resolve. This is kind of the last hurrah of real excitement in the book of Acts. And Luke puts it in here that way. It's full of action words, it's full of drama, it's full of conflict, and like a narrow escape and a kind of a miraculous set of circumstances all coming together and all framing up a very human conflict at the same time. So we're going to be taking a look at this, and we're going to sort of lay it out like a movie would be, sort of the way it reads. So first off, we're going to see the first section sets the scene. You know, it's sort of that introduction of characters, introduction of the setting, so that you can get it in your head, what's going on, who are these people that are involved. Secondly, Luke sets up the conflict, the interpersonal conflict that's going to arise in this chapter. Third, we'll have the crash or the chase scene. And lastly, we'll have the culmination or the conflict resolution. So the first section we're going to take a look at will be the first 8 verses. Let's read that together. Acts chapter 27, the first 8 verses. And this is really setting the scene and introducing the characters. When it was decided that we would sail for Italy, so we is a magic word in the book of Acts, right? That means that Luke, the author of the book of Acts, is along. Luke is now going along with Paul. It was decided that we would sail for Italy. They proceeded to deliver Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustinian cohort named Julius. And embarking in an Adramyttian ship, which was about to sail to the regions along the coast of Asia, we put out to sea accompanied by Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica. The next day we put in at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul with consideration and allowed him to go to his friends and receive care. From there we put out to sea and sailed under the shelter of Cyprus, because the winds were contrary. When we had sailed through the sea along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we landed at Myra in Lycia. There the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing for Italy, and he put us aboard it. When we had sailed slowly for a good many days, and with difficulty had arrived off Cnidus, since the wind did not permit us to go farther, we sailed under the shelter of Crete, off Salamone. And there, with difficulty sailing past it, we came to a place called Fair Havens, near which was the city of Lasea. Lots of names in this section, right? So for those of you who are geographically minded, this makes sense, right? You're like, ah, yeah, this is like MapQuest, right? Or Google Maps. From here to here, that takes about that many hours, that many days, right? Here's this many miles. You got that all going on in your head. That's what Luke is doing. He's setting this up. They leave the coast of Palestine, and they travel by this trade ship, and it's a coastal trade ship. This is not a big ship that travels out through the middle of the Mediterranean Sea. It's a smaller vessel. It's a trading ship. It goes and it calls in at all the ports along the way, buying and selling goods. And on board is Luke and Paul and Aristarchus. Now, Aristarchus is a name you should recognize. Aristarchus came along with Paul to Jerusalem when he came back from his third missionary journey. He was one of the men who was from Macedonia that Paul had brought as a companion. They went up the coast, but it was very slow going. So according to the calendar in the book of Acts that we're given, this is approaching the end of sailing season in the Mediterranean during that part of history. The weather in the Mediterranean shifts in October from being a place where it's all right to being a place where it's not all right to be. And they're getting near that time. So they would be feeling the pressure of getting on with things as quickly as they possibly can. They don't want to be caught somewhere between Palestine and Italy. They want to get it done with before the weather turns and they get stuck somewhere. Julius, it says, is a centurion of the Augustan cohort. He's one of the emperor's own legionnaires. The Roman Caesar had his own special legion. This was one of them. He was, you can consider him sort of a courier here. He'd probably been sent by Caesar to Palestine with orders, dispatches, communications for Festus and other officials. He would not have been there commanding a troop stationed in the Middle East. He would have been there on Caesar's business and would be returning to Caesar and charged to bring these prisoners back with him by Festus as the Roman governor. So he's not one of Festus's normal troops. He's one of the emperor's special troops. And he is not only just a soldier, but he's an officer. So he's an important man in the Roman military. He goes along and they travel up. And they go along the coast, they travel, it says, they put out to sea and they sailed along in the shelter, after they get up a little ways, sorry, they stop at Sidon, and something important happens there. You see, Julius and Paul have a good relationship. Julius allows Paul and his companions to go off board and go into the city to receive care by Paul's friends in Sidon. That's pretty unusual, right? If you were a guard, a Roman prison guard, and you were taking prisoners to Caesar, you're not likely to let them off the ship, are you? I mean, come on. It's hard to get away on board a ship, especially if you're chained up. In a city, much easier to escape. So Julius either knows something about Paul and has heard that Paul's being taken off to Caesar for no good reason, perhaps, or it might be that Paul has already just started to have a relationship with Julius. We'll see that relationship is going to grow and deepen. But this is the beginning of it. And again, Luke is setting things up for us. So this is an important interpersonal point to note, that Julius is already giving Paul some special treatment, some favors, that he's being treated well. From Sidon, they have to continue north, but they have to go out a ways, and they have to get into the lee of Cyprus. So Cyprus is that big triangular-shaped island over in the eastern Mediterranean. They went out a ways to get behind it so that the northwesterly wind that would have prevented them from continuing north was blocked by the island, so they could go a ways before they could tack back over to the mainland to get up to Asia. And they manage that, and they go on up. But the winds were very contrary. So this was a slow go. They're having to quarter against the wind to make their way. Yeah, it's bad enough. They finally get to this place called Myra in Lycia up along the Asia Minor coast. And the centurion has either had it with this ship or that ship is done. That's as far as it's going. So they decide they're going to switch vessels. And they switch over to an Alexandrian ship sailing for Italy. So we don't know a ton about that first boat they were on, but this Alexandrian ship we do know quite a bit about. We'll see later on that it was carrying grain, and that's consistent with what these ships would have been like. This kind of ship was a big trade barge. It was one of the larger vessels that was around at that time. It would have been somewhere in the region of 180 feet long, which is really giant for a wooden ship. 180 feet long, 45 feet wide, and up to 43 feet deep. Really large, carried a lot of grain, and later on we're going to see it carries close to 300 people on board as well. Massive vessel. And so it can handle going out farther at sea. It doesn't have to be a coastal vessel. And these ships would have traveled, as the grain basket of the Middle East and the Mediterranean world is, at that time, all Egypt. The Nile River valley was so prolifically abundant that these ships would travel from Egypt up along the Middle East coast, delivering whatever they're going to deliver, and then they'd cut over across, hit Greece, hit Italy, and back down, and that was sort of the trade triangle that it would be traveling on. So this would be a merchant vessel, not a military vessel. But this commander of guards in Caesar's legion would have been an important person and had significant powers to direct civilians in the Roman Empire. And so when he gets on board, it's probable that he didn't go and acquire passage by paying this commander or this ship captain. He probably went and said, "You are taking us with you to Italy," and there's no argument about it. So they go ahead and leave there. And when they come down, they can follow along. Picture it in your head. They come down along the coast of Greece, the eastern shore of Greece. And again, this time of the year, these winds would have been coming sort of from the northwest generally. That's a predominant direction of the wind. So they would have sailed close to the coast to avoid the strong winds and be able to use the north part of it and avoid the western and southern aspects of the breeze. But when they get down to the bottom of Greece, they're exposed. There's no longer landmass there, and they have to go northwest into a northwest wind, for a wind-driven sailing vessel is impossible. So they head straight south and go down to Crete, where they can now use Crete. They go around the western tip of Crete and along the bottom of Crete, again in the lee, until they get to this place called Fair Haven, a good place to put in, a nice deep water port along the south side of Crete. So that's where they are at the end of this section that I would call the setup. This is how they got there. This is who the people are, the characters. So now we enter into the real beginning of the setup of the interpersonal conflicts that we're going to see exacerbated by what God does with nature. And that's the next few verses we'll look at setting up the conflict here in verses 9 through 12. When considerable time had passed and the voyage was now dangerous, since even the fast was already over, Paul began to admonish them and said to them, "Men, I perceive that the voyage will certainly be with damage and great loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives." But the centurion was more persuaded by the pilot and the captain of the ship than by what was being said by Paul. Because the harbor was not suitable for wintering, the majority reached the decision to put out to sea from there if somehow they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete facing southwest and northwest, and spend the winter there. All right, so again, a little geography. We won't have a lot more geography in this story, but you gotta get it in your head what's going on and why they make these decisions. At that time, the the geography of the coast of Crete was a little different. There's been volcanic activity and earthquakes and everything, but there was a kind of a little horn that stuck out the bottom of Crete. They were on the east side of the horn. That's a bad side to winter on. Even today, the people don't winter their boats in fair havens. It's not a good spot. But if they could circle around the bottom of that horn and get up into the west side, there was another port over there that was called Phoenix. That's a much better place to winter the boat. It's about 40 miles. So one really good day of sailing and they can do it. But the winds have been contrary all the way thus far. And Paul is an experienced traveler. He's been around, right? He's been on some ships. He's a smart guy. He knows what's going on. And he says, guys, this is a bad idea. The winds are bad. We don't need to set out. Once we get around that horn, right, there's nothing. Again, there's open water for a little ways. We've got to cross, and then we've got to get up going against the wind into that little harbor. This is going to be hard to do. And Paul, basically, this isn't prophecy, right? He's not saying the Lord says that we're going to have loss. He's just saying, this is a bad idea. Think about it. But the centurion, Julius, he listens to Paul, but he doesn't listen to Paul. He hears what Paul is saying, but he hears what the ship's captain says and the crew, and he says, yeah, I think we'll go for it. We'll try it. So here's the beginning of this conflict that we're going to set up for us, the story. Paul versus the crew. Paul versus the crew. Paul, it says, admonishes them. That's a pretty strong term, right? Paul's not just saying, well, you know, hey guys, my two cents is... No, he's giving them very serious words, but they fail to listen. So that's the setup of the conflict. Now we'll look at a long section. I want you to note that there's... this is like a two-part. There's the crew, and then there's Paul. And then there's the crew, and then there's Paul. So it's a two-part with two parts. Crew versus Paul, crew versus Paul, verses 13 through 38. This is what you could call the chase, or the crash, you'll see. So in verses 13 through 20, you'll see the crew's helplessness. And then you'll see in 21 through 25, Paul's calm trust. Then the second duality, the second pairing, verses 27 through 32, the crew's cravenness, and verses 33 through 38, Paul's certainty. So read along with those divisions in mind, help you set up what's going on here. So verse 13. When a moderate south wind came up, supposing that they had attained their purpose, they weighed anchor and began sailing along Crete close inshore. But before very long, there rushed down from the land a violent wind called the Euroquillo. And when the ship was caught in it and could not face the wind, we gave way to it and let ourselves be driven along, running under the shelter of a small island called Clauda. We were scarcely able to get the ship's boat under control. And after they had hoisted it up, they used supporting cables in undergirding the ship, and fearing that they might run aground on the shallows of Syrtis, they let down the sea anchor, and in this way let themselves be driven along. The next day, as we were being violently storm-tossed, they began to jettison the cargo. And on the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. Since neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small storm was assailing us, from then on, all hope of our being saved was gradually abandoned. When they had gone a long time without food, then Paul stood up in the midst and said, "Men, you ought to have followed my advice and not to have set sail from Crete and incurred this damage and loss. Yet, now I urge you to keep up your courage, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For this very night an angel of God, to whom I belong and whom I serve, stood before me, saying, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar, and behold, God has granted you all those who are sailing with you. Therefore keep up your courage, men, for I believe God that it will turn out exactly as I have been told. But we must run aground on a certain island.'" But when the 14th night came, and we were being driven about in the Adriatic Sea, about midnight, the sailors began to surmise that they were approaching some land. They took soundings and found it to be 20 fathoms. And a little farther on, they took another sounding and found it to be 15 fathoms. Fearing that we might run aground somewhere on the rocks, they cast four anchors from the stern and wished for daybreak. But as the sailors were trying to escape from the ship and had let down the ship's boat into the sea on the pretense of intending to lay out anchors from the bow, Paul said to the centurion and to the soldiers, "Unless these men remain on the ship, you yourselves cannot be saved." Then the soldiers cut away the ropes of the ship's boat and let it fall away. Until the day was about to dawn, Paul was encouraging them all to take some food, saying, "Today is the 14th day that you have been constantly watching and going without eating, having taken nothing. Therefore, I encourage you to take some food, for this is for your preservation, and not a hair from the head of any of you will perish." Having said this, he took bread and gave thanks to God in the presence of all, and he broke it and began to eat. All of them were encouraged, and they themselves also took food. All of us in the ship were 276 persons. When they had eaten enough, they began to lighten the ship by throwing the wheat into the sea. When day came, they could not recognize the land. We'll stop there. All right, so A, B, right? You see them leave Fairhaven, and as they are trying to come around, the wind is great. It's perfect. It's out of the south. They want to go north. It's perfect. But God has other plans for them. The wind that comes up here is actually a famous one. It's still known today that this time of year, this kind of thing happens. And we have it called in here a Euroquillo, but we of New England know this wind well. This is a nor'easter. This is exactly what it says. A Euroquillo is northeast. It's the northeast wind, and it's violent, and it's strong, and this is why people don't travel by sail ship in the Mediterranean in the winter. People today are perishing in the Mediterranean Sea, trying to make their way from Africa and the Middle East to Europe by sail ship, escaping violence in Africa, and dying because of this wind. They are driven away from the land. They try to resist it initially, but it's far too strong. They can't do anything but reef the sails and hope for the best at the beginning. It's too strong. The wind, the storm is amazing. They have to stay out of the rigging. Finally, when they're away far enough from land, things settle down enough that they can get things sort of squared away to try to preserve themselves. So this is how badly things go. That when they get past this small island, Claudo, it's about 25 miles southwest. They're driven initially by that storm. They can finally start to do some things, and they're afraid. We know they're afraid because they do some things that you only do when you're afraid. First off, they ready the lifeboat. They're getting ready to abandon ship already. Secondly, they tie ropes around the hull of the ship. They're afraid of the waves, the winds, that it's going to just batter the ship to pieces in the middle of the ocean. Thirdly, they put out the sea anchor. Forget steering. All they're trying to do is slow themselves down. A sea anchor is basically a sail that you put underwater. So the winds are driving the ship as hard as it can to the southwest. They put this big sail out underwater, and it collects water as it goes and slows the ship down. It's not an anchor like the kind that you drop that sits and grabs onto the bottom of the sea. It just slows the ship. It's a brake during a storm. The next day, they throw out the cargo. Now, this is a big deal, right? This is a merchant vessel. These sailors get paid by bringing cargo from shore to shore. Tossing over the cargo was to lose their livelihood this time around, right? They've lost all their profit from this voyage once they throw things overboard. And lastly, the day after that, they throw away their tackle. This is the tools of their trade. This is what they need to steer and care for the ship. Anything topside, anything they get their hands on, going overboard, lighten the ship. Keep us on top of the water. This is waves that are crashing over the deck of the ship, scaring them. They don't know where they're headed. They don't know when they're going to land. They are afraid. And finally, Luke says, they just give up hope. There's nothing else they can do. They're driven to the end. Paul talks to them at that point in verse 21 through 25. He says, you should have listened to me. Now, this isn't Paul just saying, I told you so, as much as I'm sure he would like to say that, and any of us would as well. I told you we shouldn't have left Fairhaven. But he's actually giving them a message, right? He receives a direct revelation from an angel who appears and says, no one will be lost. Not one. The 276 souls aboard the ship, not one of them will be lost, because Paul must get to Rome. That's why. Paul gives them this prophetic warning, but in the next section, the sailors' cravenness, you see, they make an excuse, right? They're going to go down and see how things are and patch up the hull a little bit. And when, by the way, we need the lifeboat to do that. So they get the lifeboat ready. Paul, seeing what they're doing, says to the soldiers, if they go, I can't promise your safety. So the soldiers stop the sailors the only way they know how. They cut free the lifeboat. No more life raft. We're all on this one together at this point. I don't think that this is prophetic by Paul, saying, if one of those sailors leaves, we all die. I think this was just pragmatic, right? He tells them, we're going to wreck. We're gonna have to beach this thing at some point. And if all the sailors leave the ship, no more crew, no way to safely do this thing. This is just pragmatism. The sailors go, we can't steer the ship. We can't land the ship. We can't do anything. So he tells them this. And the soldiers now listen to Paul, don't they? They see what he's saying, and they cut free the life raft. Lastly, we see here Paul's certainty. Paul's calmness in this storm is incredible, right? 14 days later, Paul says, sort of gathers people on the deck, says, you guys haven't been eating. You're weak. You need to eat. You need to care for yourselves. We have things to do. This isn't the end. Calm yourselves. Eat. And he even goes through the rituals here of a Jewish meal, right? He takes the bread. He gives thanks. He blesses it. He breaks it. He hands it around. This would have been sort of a calming, right? A calming effect. There's this familiar thing about it. And they listen to him. They all sit and eat. And then, as a sign of their confidence in what Paul is saying at this point, all the rest of the grain goes overboard. That's it. There's nothing left. They're preparing the ship to be beached. It's got to be as light as it can so it can get as far up onto the sand as they can get it. So here's a few implications for you up to this point. We'll cover the very last section and come back for a few more after that. But Paul here, he's not proclaiming the gospel of Jesus Christ to these people in what we see in Luke's writings. But you got to imagine that he is. And I think that he's been testifying along the way, particularly to Julius. Paul here might be ridiculed by the sailors. He might be ignored as he was there at Fairhaven. But, and Paul knows he's going to get to Italy, right? He's had it from the Lord. He knows where he's going. The Lord has told him he's going to go stand before Caesar. It wouldn't cost him anything to see these sailors and soldiers lost, would it? I mean, come on. Was it hurt him if he knows where he's going? But, no. The Lord has given him the lives of these sailors, these soldiers, and he, rather than selfishly serving himself, he serves them. He tries to help them to survive this. God uses his people to bless those around them. We're to be salt and light in this world. Sometimes that's the purest kind, bringing the gospel of Jesus Christ to a lost and dying world. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's helping someone change a tire. Sometimes it's being a good worker. Sometimes it's helping a neighbor with something they need. Sometimes it's just mundane things. Sometimes it's being the good Samaritan, right? Paul doesn't fear man. He goes out of his way to help them. It's an interesting compare and contrast. We don't have time to go into it tonight. But this story reminds me really, really tightly of an Old Testament story. Anyone know what I'm thinking of? Jonah. Read this again sometime this week, and then go read the story of Jonah, and note the interesting compare and contrast that's going on. Jonah gets the word from God that he's to go to Nineveh, and he runs away. And when the storm comes, he says to the sailors, just throw me overboard. Paul says, you're going to go stand trial before Caesar. And Paul says, let's go. Let's go. He runs toward God's word. He runs toward God's will, not away. And when the storm comes, he does what he can to save the sailors, save the soldiers. A few thoughts there. We'll get around to a few more pertinent ones at the end. But then we have the last bit, the culmination. This is the resolution of the conflict, verses 39 through 44. When day came, they could not recognize the land, but they did observe a bay with a beach, and they resolved to drive the ship onto it if they could. And casting off the anchors, they left them in the sea, while at the same time they were loosening the ropes of the rudders and hoisting the foresail to the wind. They were headed for the beach. But striking a reef where two seas met, they ran the vessel aground, and the prow stuck fast and remained immovable. But the stern began to be broken up by the force of the waves. The soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners so that none of them would swim away and escape. But the centurion, wanting to bring Paul safely through, kept them from their intention and commanded that those who could swim would jump overboard first and get to land, and the rest should follow, some on planks and others on various things from the ship. And so it happened that they were all brought safely to land. So the soldiers, as you've been taught in the past, guards, soldiers guarding prisoners in the Roman system, if you lost your prisoner, your life was forfeit. It's that simple. So they said, well, they'll probably die in the surf here, but if one of them happens to get away and they get caught later on, it's my head. So kill the prisoners and then we'll escape. Julius countermands that order. So here again, I see this conflict resolution, right? The soldiers, they're not ready to listen to Paul. Julius, on the other hand, is listening to Paul. He's considering things. We don't see that Julius is saved here, but I wonder if he is. I wonder strongly if he is, because you may recall that in one of Paul's letters, he writes that the Praetorian Guard, Caesar's own household guard, Caesar's legion, is being converted. And this might be the beginning of that. As Paul goes, he's being held prisoner, and these are the guards who would have guarded him there while he was waiting trial before Caesar. This Julius might have been Paul's first Roman convert, the first legionary convert. Julius countermands the order, and so God's promise to Paul is made true. The sailors successfully get the boat close enough to the beach, at least, that everyone can get off without dying. The ship begins to break up. So, indeed, everything is lost. Everything is lost. But no lives. So, verse 40, the beginning of verse 40 is a great soundbite for the sermon. I love this. Isn't it great when you can just take a couple words out of Scripture and there's your soundbite for a sermon? And casting off the anchors. Yeah, right? It's a great story for the Christian life. Cast off the anchors. Forget those things that are keeping you here. Forget those things that are keeping you afraid and far from God. What we were hearing about this morning, right? God's got a will for you. God has a plan for you. You don't know what it is. But when God reveals it to you, run for it. Go toward it. Cast off the anchors, right? Go for what God has for you. Paul's trust is wholly in the Lord. He's not afraid of this sea. He knows that God is the God of the sea. He's not afraid of these men. He doesn't fear those who can kill the body. He fears the one who can kill the body and the soul. Paul knows that God will accomplish his will. If God has promised Paul that he will stand before Caesar, he will stand before Caesar. There's nothing to be afraid of for Paul. Is he getting to Rome the way he thought he would get to Rome? Probably not. I don't think Paul had shipwreck penciled into his calendar for this date. So an implication for us, right? We all know where we're going, don't we? We're going home. We're headed for heaven. How we get there? Yeah. Might not be the way you think it's going. Might not be the way we planned for our trip to heaven to look. We've got things we want. We've got our plans. We've got our desires for our life. But the Lord leads us homeward according to his plan. Sometimes he sends us the nor'easter. Sometimes we suffer shipwreck. Sometimes we suffer loss. Can you do what Paul does and set your face toward what God has planned for you? Should sound kind of familiar, because Craig taught us about this not long ago when Paul was headed the other direction by sea. He was headed to Jerusalem. He was headed there to be bound, and he knew it. Here, he's headed to Rome, and he's going to what he doesn't know. In Rome, trial before Caesar, and then, who knows? Execution, release, vindication, imprisonment. Any of these are possible. But Paul's not afraid. He pursues the aims that God has set before him. So, where will God lead you? What's God going to lead you through to get you home? Illness, old age, divorce, tragedy, car accidents, loss of loved ones. We don't know. We don't know what the Lord has in plan for us. But be bold. Be bold for the Lord. Save those who are along with you on the ride as best as you're able. Preach them the word. Give them the gospel. Try your best to preserve them from their own foolishness, the way Paul did. Don't abandon them. Don't cast them off, the way you might cast off your anchors. Paul's a great example for us. Not only an example of humility in Philippians chapter 2, but this great example of a single-minded purpose and a complete lack of fear. Let's emulate him. Let's pray. Father, thank you for this passage. There's a lot to be learned here by observation. Not that Paul speaks the deep truths in these few words that he gives us about life and death and salvation and the eternal purposes of your plan. No, those things aren't here. But what we do see is a man wholly committed to you, a man who knows his maker and his master, who's not afraid, a man who does what he can for those around him, who shares wisdom when he can, who doesn't fear other men nor nature, but only the God of those things. Thank you for him. Thank you for this study. Thank you for your wonderful things that you've given us in your word, that we can see them and learn from them. And we ask that we'd have this heart in ourselves. We ask it in Christ's name and for his glory. Amen.